Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Elhamdülillahi Rabbil alemin. Ve salatu ve selamu ala seyyidil enbiya'i vel mursalin, seyyidina Muhammedin ve ala alihi ve sahbihi ecma'in. One of my bad habits when I come to places like this is to look around to see if I can determine exactly where I am. And if we look around, what do we see exactly? We see the usual generic hotel ballroom and the rooms generic and international. In fact, it seems that people pay a lot of money in order to be nowhere in particular. This is globalization, and it's our fault because it's what we want. If we didn't want it, it wouldn't happen. But I do find it strange that we could be in Bel Air or Singapore or anywhere and it would look exactly the same. Part of the modern condition is that everything is becoming homogenized. I find that strange because we religionists used to be absolutely sure that one of the fundamental human needs was to have a sense of place. Even 50 years ago, you could always tell a British hotel, the way you could tell a British suit or a British car. And yes, the country was crabbed, introspective, xenophobic, jingoistic, but at least it did have a sense of place, and that was important to people. Now what puzzles me as I look around is that that no longer seems to be terribly important to us, except on the far right and the skinhead fringes of the EDL and the BNP and all those other acronyms that are now popping up, but I suspect that they too haven't got a clue what the local story is actually about. That's one of the things that we've lost. Another thing, it seems to me, is a sense of family. And again, we theologians are furrowing our brows. Why is it that we always assumed human beings needed kinship, celebration of ancestors? We could name all of our great-great-grandparents until certainly my parents' generation. We all believed in the extended family, and now we've let that go, and we hardly think that we've lost something. My grandmother was at a nursing home on the south coast, and one Christmas time I asked the matron of this establishment how many other guests at this nursing home received visitors for Christmas. And she said that my grandmother was the only one. The others were all kind of airbrushed out of the consciousness of their families. That again, for those who believe that there are certain human constants and family is one of them, is perplexing. But this is where we are. Perhaps the most puzzling thing to me, though, is that we have lost sight, and don't seem to be missing it at all, of the most fundamental thing that constituted our humanity, which was a belief in the beyond, the unseen, a world of gods, of spirits, of the divine, which used to constitute our lives, give them richness, give them hope for eternity after death, and that has gone out of focus for the great majority of people, certainly here in Europe. There are reasons for that. But what I find particularly strange is that people don't seem to be missing its absence, the way we theologians always were sure that they would. We are homo religiosus, we are naturally religious. Maybe there's a God gene. There's something about us that craves confidence in an unseen realm, in a deeper layer of truth, of light, of meaning and hope behind the carapace, the substance of physical reality. But somehow, we're not missing it, as far as I can tell. The religions here are in a state of decline, but they're not being replaced. There isn't a spiritual vacuum. Nature doesn't seem to abhor a spiritual vacuum. We're just in a vacuum. We're nothings spiritually, and we don't seem to mind. The reason why I'm going on about this is, first of all, that it does seem to be inherently strange that we are in this, not just post-modern age, as they say, but a post-everything age. All of the things that constituted our sense of identity, belonging to a story of meaning, of hope, have kind of gone and not been replaced by very much, and we don't mind very much. But that whenever we try to talk about big traditional things of faith, beauty, meaning, immortality, the virtues, that we inhabit a culture where those things are now alien and strange. Giving a talk about religion, even 50 years ago, would have been far easier for a Muslim, despite the jingoism and the racism and the xenophobia and those other things that unquestionably were more common then, would have been a lot easier than it is today.
Because there was a shared language of faith. There was an awareness of biblical stories. There was an awareness of it being normal that people should have a final hope and an ultimate sense of meaning and destination, that even if they were filthy sinners, they knew that there would be a judgment and that a merciful God was waiting for them at the end. For most people, that's not really a living part of their consciousness, which makes our task as Muslim believers, and our community is, at the moment at any rate, who knows what the future holds, at the moment still a pretty devout community. When we try to explain ourselves to the outside world, that is, saying things about us, sometimes understanding us well, sometimes not understanding us so well, we find it hard to create a bridge of communication. We can talk to traditional Catholics, Christians, Jews, most traditional religionists. It's a strain. We disagree on many things. But there is a common ground there. Speaking to our current age of slackening, the global monoculture where people are too preoccupied with the latest iPhone to have time to think about anything more profound, is a lot more difficult. And this is one of the challenges for religious leaders and religious advocates today. How do we express ourselves prophetically, as we're required to do, religiously? How do we explain why we are useful to the wider world when our sense of human flourishing, our sense of meaning, our definition of what human beings are for is radically incompatible with that of the postmodern reality? There's a lot of talk about religion, a lot of talk between religions, a lot of atheist polemic against religion, a lot of religious fundamentalist polemic against other religions and against the modern world. There's a lot of chatter going on out there, but not much real communication, as far as I can tell. And we're all to blame. Whose fault is it, for instance, that you can read the Times from cover to cover every day for a year and still not be able to name a single Muslim leader? You might have spent thousands of hours fretting about Libya and Iran and British Muslims and all of those things that are important, but still you don't know what Muslims believe. You don't know who speaks for the Muslims. The most fundamental questions have not been answered. Maybe it's the fault of secular journalists that traffic only in current affairs and don't do meaning. But maybe it's also the fault of the Muslim leadership that, as yet, for a whole raft of reasons, hasn't found an adequate voice for communication, doesn't know how to, and sometimes it's almost like shouting, it's a strain, to get oneself heard across this widening gulf between the world of faith, which Muslims still choose to inhabit very enthusiastically, and where everybody else seems to be going. So that is our predicament, and I suspect that most of the blame falls on the side of the Muslims, because after all, it is primarily the responsibility of a minority, if it feels itself to be improperly understood, to make itself understood. In any case, if we consider that this is our very strange situation, that this island has been really into religion and into rituals since the time of Stonehenge, I guess, if not longer, which is quite a long time, until living memory, we've come kind of just too late to see this island in its natural religious state. If we're here in this very odd post-situation, what can be made of it? Well, all is not lost, because from the Muslim perspective, despite appearances, there is something at the root of every human soul, and we do use that word, which does want to know if anything means anything at all. However jaded you might be by a popular culture that laughs at anything that might seem to be profound, that where cynicism and smart aleck kind of sarcasm is the tone of popular debate, whether it be the pages of the Times Literary Supplement or Have I Got News For You, everybody adopts that know-it-all sort of sarcastic put-down of anything that seems to be ancient, traditional, deep, serious. If you inhabit that world, how can you hear? Well, we would say you can, because deep down there is a sense of amazement which you may not be able to acknowledge. Often I don't acknowledge it. It's a universal human condition. Remember, I'm not talking primarily about Muslims and Christians. I'm talking about religion and the modern reality. Because human beings have a capacity for amazement which can't quite be blunted. It's amazing that the world exists at all. It's profoundly unexpected, counterintuitive, weird, but there it is, and not just a kind of grey goo, but this world with all of its immensity and its natural laws and its gigantic, terrifying physical forces and exploding galaxies and the beauty of the nebulas and babies, and it's pretty extraordinary. Something within us wants to figure out why this is so amazing and what it might be. More weird than that is the fact that it can be perceived, and recently the head of the French National Observatory, Bruno Guidardoni, gave a lecture in Cambridge, and he was asked, what is the strangest thing in the physical world? And as a scientist who deals with galaxies, he said, the strangest thing about the physical world is that it can be perceived. That's what we can't understand at all, philosophically, scientifically. That it exists is something that we're working on. That it can be perceived and interpreted and understood is beyond our powers of reflection and does seem to be staggeringly unlikely. But empirically, there it is. The world exists and we are experiencing it. Again, within us is something that wants to know what on earth that could be. And we've only got a few decades here before we all go into a hole in the ground. Can we do something with that sense of amazement? Even more extraordinarily is the fact that we seem to have not just an ability to perceive the world, but an ability to relate to each other that seems to be endlessly rich and fruitful and paradoxical. People relate to each other. They have friends, they have enemies, they have spouses, they have children. One of the richest things about us is that we can somehow empathize with that mysterious spark of consciousness that we know to exist in the physical form of another human being. Again, an extraordinary thing, and novelists and playwrights are all about exploring that paradox of our sense of human empathy and the ethical richness and paradox that goes with that. How do we deal with that sense of amazement and the sheer cumulative improbability of everything? Well, what religion proposes is that a system such as this is not its own explanation. That is profoundly, intuitively unlikely. At a level deeper than the science and the philosophy and all of those finite instruments that human beings develop, but in many cases haven't actually got very far with in the case of philosophy. We haven't got much towards certainty over the last two and a half millennia since Plato and Aristotle. It's the same old questions, by and large. That at a deeper level, the existential level, the basic, essential I, looking out at all of this, we intuit that there is something behind it, that as the Indians say, water is not generated in the well. Water comes from outside the well. And that's what this world is. It doesn't come from itself. It's not self-sustaining. It's not qayyum, as the Arabs would say. It is dependent, contingent, muhdath, brought into being, dependent. That, again, is an awareness that's pre-rational, sub-rational, intuitive, and from that level of our consciousness that we should be able to trust most profoundly, because the mind can play tricks. The scientists change their theories every few years, but that basic assurance, which is what we call faith, is something that is at the ground of our being, and everybody, I suspect, has it in some way or another, even if they would die rather than admit to it. Where does that come from? Well, this is where the specifically Muslim theology comes in. What I've been saying so far could be said by a representative of any religion. The Quran speaks of the human soul, the ruh, as being precisely that deep mystery within us that perceives, that is a self that doesn't seem to be explicable in terms of matter and time and space, that isn't just part of the physical world. And philosophers of mind, as they're called, will speculate as to whether artificial intelligence is possible. But maybe one day the internet will wake up and send us emails saying, I've got a lot of information about different world religions and I've decided that Zoroastrianism is the true religion. And we'll all get that email and that would change the world. But of course, it's not doing that. It's more complicated than a human brain, but it's just a passive tool full of information and processes the information subject to the way in which its bits have been programmed. Consciousness, reflection, that mystery of perceiving the other, particularly ethically perceiving the other, is something that is in a different category to what that simply mechanical mind can do. What is within us, and this is about trust and intuition and experience, is something that is remembering reality. Just about all the world religions say, this world is not the real story. It's too unlikely and weird to be the real story. Behind multiplicity, kathra, there is unity, wahda. The best explanation for the many is the one. And the best definition of the one is that it is categorically simple and unitary, the source of everything that exists. And we all know that. We have that recollection, that memory in our souls, and this is where specifically Muslim teachings come in, which is that the Quran describes a time, before all this stuff was created, when all human souls, these little stars, these luminous points of consciousness, were brought together before Al-Haq, the real, the source, the one, فَأَشْهَدَهُمْ عَلَىٰ أَنفُسِهِمْ. And he caused us all to testify about ourselves. And what did he say? أَلَسْتُ بِرَبِّكُمْ. Am I not your Lord? And we said, بَلَىٰ شَهِدْنَا. Yes, we testify. This is called mushahada, witnessing. We were there with the one, with reality, not this stuff. We were with what logically is behind everything. And we all said, yes, we bear witness. And that is our innate state. That is what we are at our deepest level. When all of the rubbish and the distraction and the smart aleck preoccupation with stuff is scraped away, at the deepest level, we are ones who bear witness and remember that primordial moment. That's where Islam starts to diverge from Christianity. Christianity diagnoses the basis of the human condition as being sinfulness, the inherited sin of Adam. Islam doesn't quite do that. There's many areas of overlap between Christianity and Islam, but not this area. Islam diagnoses our predicament, our sense of unease, disquiet, curiosity, as being not sin, but forgetfulness. We've forgotten what we are. We were there in what the Persian poets like Rumi called Bezmi Alast, the party of the primordial covenant, the party of Am I Not Your Lord? All humanity, without exception, before the religions, before races, before everything, everybody equally saying that, men and women equally saying, yes, we bear witness. We are all that at the deepest level, but we've forgotten. So that's the first thing to know about Islam's assessment of the mystery of the human condition. We are forgetters. Some of the Arabic dictionaries will even tell you that the Arabic word, the Quranic word for human being, insan, is related to the Arabic word nisyan, which means forgetfulness. That's what defines us. We forget things, and not just forgetting the name of the people we're sitting next to, but forgetting the thing that really matters, which is the thing that helps everything to make sense, which is the wahda, the one, the source, the point of origin. So what we need to do is to remember, not to be saved, again using the Christian language, but to remember. We've forgotten, we need to remember. We need dhikr. How do we accomplish that? Well, we need to remember that we're not here for very long, and that helps us to realize that actually it's quite important to try and sort these things out, because if we can find out a structure of meaning in our lives, that's going to make everything else a whole lot more interesting. But we are in this world of clay, as the Quran puts it. Adam is made water and clay, this base stuff, and here we are, and we're not here for very long. And we're all going out by the same point. We're all going into the same hole in the ground. This is the universal human condition. And we need to remember where we came from. So the poet Rumi says, Za'asimani tuchu baran bebame alim ikhak behersui bidavide binavidan rafti. Like the rain you came down upon the clay roof of the world, You ran around for a little while like drops, and then you went out through the gutter. That's what human beings are. We come from above, from the heavens, Asuman, and there we're on the clay roof of this world running around and getting dirty, and we go out through the same gutter. But while we're here, we have to figure out what this is about, because not doing that is kind of missing the only opportunity we're going to get. But it's not about logic chopping. It's not about 10 arguments for the existence of God. That's all finite arguments trying to reach to the infinite realm, and it can only take you as far as refuting certain things that are obviously wrong. The deep argument is in your soul. Look within. And every religion has said that. The truth is within you. It's not about logic chopping and philosophical smartness. It's about looking in and in and in, beyond the ego and all the rubbish and the insecurities and the nonsense that we know that is in there. Behind all of that, under the layers of garbage, decades of garbage, in my case, 5 decades of garbage, and it's getting more, at the bottom of that, there is the memory, the remembrance of Al-Wahid, the One. So we need to get rid of the rubbish, and certainly we need to stop more of it coming in. And again, here, Islam, like every other religion, says there's two parts within us. There is the spirit, the ruh, the imperishable bit that is mysteriously conscious and that saw the One and will be returned to the One. And there is the false self, the nafs, the ego, which is what we are most of the time, which is when we want to put up a facade for others, when we're insecure about how we look, when all of the rubbish that we waste our few decades with. And we need to overcome that lower self and then discover what we really are. And that is difficult, but it's also immensely sweet because it's a process of enlightenment. It's hard to overcome the ego, especially in modern times where ego is everything. Without ego, where would capitalism be? Where would advertising be? Where would anything be? Where would any of our popular music be? It's all about ego. Be yourself, even though the self is never defined, turns out to be a very kind of evanescent thing when you really think about what the ego is made of. But still, the modern world is all about be yourself, discover yourself, assert yourself, but doesn't tell you what the self is. We need to go beyond that, transcend it, fight against it with a bloody sword of inward strife and combat, get rid of all the egotism and the showing off and the self-deceit and the rubbish to see what's underneath. And what is underneath, and again, universal religious teaching is the imperishable spirit, that which pre-existed all of this strange stuff. And access to that is what helps everything to make sense. And again, not in terms of finally deciding which of those arguments for the existence of God might make sense or not, but in terms of mushahada, seeing. Ultimately, religion is about what one of our great imams and leaders, Al-Ghazali, called dhawq, tasting. You can talk about what the main course is going to taste like. You can talk endlessly, and you can read about it on the menu, but unless you've tasted it, you haven't really experienced it. And that's what it is to be in one spirit again. It's like looking at the moon. You can describe the moon to a blind person as much as you like, but he'll have only a very strange conception of what you might be talking about. But when you open your eyes and you see it, then you know that it exists and everything is in perspective. But being alive spiritually is more than that. It's more than just seeing another object in creation that you'd only speculated about through analogy. It's about seeing al-haq, reality, how things actually are, and beginning to make sense of the otherwise unbearably stressful fact of multiplicity and time and death and relationships and all of the stuff that stress us out, sometimes to the point of making us ill. Seeing beyond all of that, seeing that everything is completely in the grip of al-haq, reality. Everything is as it should be. Everything is the only way it could be. And what we are required to do is to conform ourselves to those qualities of perfection. Overcome the nasty vices and the selfishness and the rubbish and become courageous, become selfless, become good neighbors, become good spouses, become just. All of those traditional virtues, and I guess the list of virtues is more or less the same, again, in all of the world religions, ornament yourself with those things, and those doors will open, and you will start to figure out what you really are, and the false self, which is really just a ball and chain, which is wasting your life, will be cut away and will disappear, and you can spread your wings and go back. And that, again, is a common theme of our literature. Tu bazi khas budi dar vesari pirzani, chu table baz shenidi belami khan rafti. Rumi again says, you were a royal falcon in the grip of an old woman. But then you heard the falconer's drum and you flew up to the place which is no place. And the falcon is what we are, the royal falcon, because we belong to the king. Subhanahu wa ta'ala, al-wahid, al-haq, al-qahar, the unitary source of everything, we belong to him. Because we said that at the beginning of our experience. Bala shahidna, yes, we bear witness. That's where we crave to be, not in the grip of this thing. And the old woman in the Persian poetry is a symbol for the world. From a distance, she looks really sexy. You get up close and actually it's not quite so great. And that's our experience always with our worldly pleasures. The new car, I save up for it. I break my back working overtime for 3 years. For 2 days it's really great and then kind of, well, it gets stolen, the fuel consumption, I need a new model, all of that stuff. Everything in the world eventually ends up with the taste that isn't quite the taste that we wanted, and it deceives us again and again and again. So we need to escape from that grip and we need to fly. How do we fly? And that's the next thing that the poem says. When you heard the falconer's drum, then you go to the place which is no place. Belamikan Ravti. And we do need somebody to bang a drum to wake us up. Because our nature is to kind of keep grazing. The world is kind of interesting. There's a lot of stuff going on here, and you can do one thing and another thing and another thing, and you're at the crematorium. And it didn't last very long, but that's what you get. But you need somebody to bang a drum hard in order to wake you up. You need dhikr, to be reminded, if you are going to remember. Another Muslim doctrine comes in here. The one, the source, the beyond everything, because its nature is compassion, because its nature is perfection, wants us to wake up. When you speak of will in the context of God, you're doing something that's a complicated analogy. It's not like us deciding to have eggs on toast for breakfast. The divine will is something not analogous to that. But we use this kind of language. The real, subhanahu wa ta'ala, wishes us to wake up. Doesn't like to see us grazing like sheep, munching, never looking up once in our lives. Because there's always another tussock of grass that looks juicy and that's our life. It doesn't want us to be like that because we're not made for that. We're made for angelic realms and higher than angelic realms. Ma bi felek budeim, jari melek budeim, hemanji ravim khajike an shahremast. We were born to be children of the spheres, companions of the angels. Let us go there again, friend, because that is our city. An shahremast, that's where we belong. That's our home, that's where our souls, which are like birds in the cage of the body, crave to fly to. That's the universal human experience of wanting to transcend this stuff and this prison, and we can't articulate it. And the modern world doesn't know how to deal with that impulse. But it is there. Everybody wishes to fly. Not the ancient human fantasy of wanting to flap your wings, and the reality of modern travel, air travel, is, of course, Ryanair, which is divine punishment for human beings having the wrong kind of fantasy for thousands of years. But the real desire to fly is what constitutes us as human beings, and the sheep don't have it, and the roses don't have it. We have it. We have that desire to move up, to see the one, to go back to the place where we belong, the land of the angels. That's our city. But the one who's in charge of the eagles has to bang his drum hard because we're involved with all of this stuff. So he continues to bang his drum, but we're really sleepy at the moment. It's like waking up my teenagers for school when there's a test. Their sense of hearing seems to have been miraculously deactivated. We're all like that. He bangs away, and he does this by monotheistic Quranic language, again, sending prophets. What does a prophet do? He doesn't ask for payment or anything at all. He's just saying, wake up. He's shaking you. قم قم يا حبيبي كم تنام النوم على العاشق حرام. Wake up, my beloved, you're sleeping too long. Don't you know that sleep is forbidden for lovers? You're supposed to be awake and contemplating the beauty of the empyrean, of the transcendent. You're just kind of dozing away. Now, the prophet is there to shake you, to wake you up, to bang a drum. And sometimes it can be scary language because he reminds you of where your lower nature wants to take you. And we all know where that can be. The huge infernal realms that we see when we open a trapdoor and look into our own lower possibilities, and it smells bad, but we have that tendency. He's holding us back by the scruff of our neck, saying, don't go there, look up. He can't force you into heaven. The function of a prophet or a saint is not to drag you by the scruff of your neck into heaven, is to say, look up. That's what you really are, for the realm of beauty, the realm of transcendence, for the realm of stillness, for the realm of truth, and not the kind of infernal stuff that is waiting for you if you insist on just looking down all the time. Look up. Asumani tu, the heavens, the divine heavens. And that's what a prophet does. Another piece of Quranic teaching, there hasn't just been one, there's been a gigantic number, and we don't even know their names. The Quran says, we'll just tell you some of their names. There isn't room to list them all. The Quran says, وَلِكُلِّ قَوْمٍ هَادٍ, for every people there has been sent a guide. Again, this might look different from certain interpretations of Christianity. There's only one perfect intersection of heaven and earth. Christ, the sacrifice, is the pivotal event of human salvation history. Again, Muslims think differently. The Quran says every one of those prophets has been there to bang a loud drum to wake his sleepy people up. Every one of those prophets has offered equivalently valid salvation. Salvation is salvation, reaching the one again, experiencing the perfect realms of proximity to the source. That's one thing. And all of the prophets have taught that. And many of the stories in the Quran are familiar to those who are familiar with the biblical stories. And they're slightly retold, but the basic message is stop messing around in Egypt, wake up and make a pilgrimage for God. So Moses and the parting of the waves is certainly there in the Quran. Joseph and his brothers are there in the Quran. Abraham and his sons, Noah, the stories are there. And the basic message is, wake up. Don't follow your own ego because that leads to catastrophe. Wake up and the promised land is there. But while I'm talking about prophets, another Islamic difference, which is the figure of Abraham. The book of Genesis is very brilliantly constructed, and you can spend lifetime just unraveling the layers of meaning in any of its great stories. They are archetypal, endlessly fruitful. And one of the big stories is the story of Abraham and his two sons. And it is at that point that the two big families, perhaps the two most significant religious traditions there have ever been, diverge. Abraham has an older son, Ishmael, and a younger son, Isaac, and Isaac is, for the authors of the book of Genesis, regarded as the heir to the covenant. Everything interesting and valid in salvation history will happen through Isaac, including his descendants, and ultimately Jesus himself, alayhi salam, is from that line. Ishmael, the older son, is, on the usual interpretation of Genesis, kind of unnecessary, a prototype. And indeed, Abraham sends him off into the desert. But he is regarded by Muslims unanimously as the sort of proto-Muslim, the ancestor of Islam. That big story, Abraham and his two sons, the one who is favored and privileged and the other who is rejected, is at the root of a lot of modern issues, clashes of civilizations. The sibling rivalry between Isaac and Ishmael needs to be understood the way Muslims understand it, if you're going to figure out how we Muslims, a quarter of the planet, see things. For Muslims, it isn't either or. Isaac is a great prophet of God and celebrated as such in the Quran, and we respect and revere as perfected divine messengers his prophetic descendants, including, and perhaps particularly, Sayyidina Isa, or Jesus, whose mother has a whole chapter to herself in the Quran. But Ishmael is also of interest to us. Ishmael is significant because if you've looked at the story in Genesis, you'll see that Abraham is really old. He's in his 80s. But he's had this amazing visitation from an angel who's told him that he will have children and descendants as many as the stars in the sky. His wife is older than he is, and this seems like kind of the news came a bit late. They're almost in their Zimmer frames, but he's going to be the patriarch of everybody. But what he does in order to fulfill the promise is to engage in what we would nowadays call surrogate motherhood. He gets a young woman, a slave girl, a bondsmaid from Egypt, Hagar, in order to bear his child. Sarah can't, she's ancient, but Hagar is young and nubile, and probably Abraham didn't mind too much this particular way of conforming to the divine instruction. But she gives birth to Ishmael. And then, another miracle, Sarah, in her dotage, becomes pregnant, Isaac is born, and the covenant seems to shift in that direction. But as Muslims understand it, no, they're both valid. And that's important to understand, because Abraham got his face on the cover of Time magazine about 5 years ago, and there are a lot of rather silly stories about how we can understand the clash of civilizations between Judeo-Christian civilization and Islam in terms of this story in the book of Genesis. And they thought all Jews and Christians reject Ishmael, all Muslims reject Isaac, so it's kind of hopeless and we all need to be secular instead. But the Muslim understanding is that we accept both of them. Both of them are accepted. Both of them are heirs to Abraham's promise. Ishmael is particularly interesting because Ishmael is half Gentile, which for the authors of the book of Genesis means a lot. She's from Egypt. She's the other. And her progeny are, as Muslims understand it, to be the harbingers of a new way of universalizing monotheism, which isn't just for the Jewish people, heirs to the promise and the covenant, but to everybody. Her Egyptianness is the sign that her prophetic descendant will be a prophet to his bu'ithulim nasi kafa, as he says, sallallahu alayhi wasallam, I am sent to all mankind. And there's a great secret for this, and it's a very important deep drama in the Muslim imagination. The one who is rejected, she's ethnically not pure, she's just a single mother, sent out into the desert and presumably to die. That's the only conceivable outcome. In fact, through God's providence, becomes the ancestress of the final prophet, who is Muhammad of Mecca, whose descendants are now a quarter of the inhabitants of the world. God is with the outcast. God is with the ethnically mixed and despised. God is with the weak single mother and the child. God is with the outcast. Fundamental part of the Muslim self-understanding, particularly in the modern world, because the Muslims have been left behind by the great imperial and economic powers of the modern world. Islam is kind of trudging along behind the pace setters in Washington and London and Paris and being asked to keep up. And in, of course, European cities, Muslims often are suspected, despised, not terribly welcome underclass. From the Muslim perspective, that's kind of as you would expect. God is with the underclass. God is with the rejected. God is with the despised. In the great cathedral tower cities of the modern world, God is with the Bangladeshi taxi drivers in their mosque who nobody gives a thought to. He's not with the privileged bankers as they have their lunches on their expense account. God is with those people, the most despised people in the modern world, are the people God is with. That's an important thing to understand if you want to know how Muslims construct and understand their status in the modern West. We've reached the story of Muhammad bin Abdullah, the Ishmaelite prophet, in the sanctuary city of Mecca, and we call the sanctuary there Al-Haram, the great sanctuary. And if you want to know why that dreadful Tunisian mafioso Ben Ali was allowed into Saudi Arabia, one reason for that is that it's a rule of sanctuary, that anybody who seeks refuge in the holy cities has to be granted refuge in the holy cities. Even a non-Muslim, interestingly, in most schools of Islamic law, it's haram and aminan, it's a secure place and a sanctuary. The center of the sanctuary is the Kaaba, which was built by Abraham and Ishmael, as Muslims believe, to be the kind of core monotheistic shrine where so much else will go wrong, but here there will be the possibility of the recollection of Al-Wahid, the one God. But things don't go according to plan. It becomes a pagan shrine. The local tribes built 300 little shrines and idols around it, and it becomes a kind of party for paganism, and monotheism is almost but not quite forgotten. And it's into that very unpromising environment that the Holy Prophet is born. And this again is worth thinking about, because one could say, and probably I guess should, that Islam is the only religion that was born into a world that was entirely kind of incongruous with it. Jesus is preaching to his own people who are Jews, fellow monotheists. He doesn't have to go a million miles in order to communicate with them. The Buddha, I guess, is talking to an Indic world where they already have ideas of reincarnation and analogous views of the self. But Mecca in the 7th century doesn't believe in one God, it believes in 360 gods. Doesn't believe in universal ethics and laws, it believes in every tribe for itself. Doesn't believe in life after death. In fact, it's the opposite of what monotheism strives to be. So into that very improbable environment, he is born, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, and the historians say that's so that God can show the greatness of the man in order to realize, humanity can realize the miraculous nature of this transformation in history. So he yanks them in 23 short years as a prophet of the one God, of Abraham, really from one end of the religious spectrum to the other. They didn't believe in anything after death. Now they're kind of totally focused on it. They didn't believe in one God, but they had lots of gods. Now they're strict monotheists. They didn't have a law. Now they've got the Sharia, the revealed law of Islam. And so profound is that transformation, to historians, a very unlikely kind of sudden transformation, that not only does it outlast his death in the year 632, but it goes on through conquests, spiritual and physical, to occupy much of the known world. And, even bigger miracle, the inhabitants of those conquered lands end up trading up to the religion of the conquerors. The most ancient, profound Christian cities and Zoroastrian cities in the world end up becoming Muslim. There is a huge spiritual principle that is being unleashed. If the Christians of the great patriarchal cities like Jerusalem, Antioch, Alexandria and elsewhere hadn't seen something extraordinary in those barefoot conquerors, they would have stayed in church, presumably. Nobody was forcing them to go to the mosque instead, but they wanted to go to the mosque. They saw something in those men and women that melted their hearts and made them realize that this is indeed God banging the drum again. It's happened again. It didn't just stop arbitrarily. God has not forgotten about us. He's banging even harder this time, and it's time for a return to an absolutely pure, austere Abrahamic monotheism. And so the story continues, and here we are through that man and the sacrifices he made in 7th century Arabia, and the story goes on. Quarter of the world's population now, rapidly growing communities in England and elsewhere, and to outsiders often alarmingly vibrant, but there's a reason for that vibrancy, and it's not just the ethnic minority's desire to hold on to an outmoded identity. It's because of the power of the idea and the human desire for al-wahid, for the one, to spread one's wings and to get back to reality. Even if it's the little toothless Bangladeshi taxi driver in the mosque that nobody in the outside world, none of his passengers ever bothered to talk to, that's where truth is in this age, exactly where the power structures couldn't imagine it could possibly be. But the banging of the drum is not just in 7th century Arabia, there's basic practices which go with us, because we're all sleepy, certainly Muslims are pretty sleepy, and we need waking up. Five times a day, it's not an easy option. Islam is not an easy option as a religion. Five times a day, you have to pray. And not just sort of like that for a few seconds, but it takes a few minutes, and you have to wash beforehand, you have to be in an appropriate place, you have to face the sanctuary of Abraham in Mecca, which is the symbol of the eternity of God himself, five times a day for the rest of your life. I remember waking up, being woken up, 4:30 in the morning, the day after I became Muslim, and I thought, the rest of my life could be some time. But, النوم على العاشق حرام, as Rumi says, it's forbidden for lovers to sleep. If you really want the source, if you want that meaning and to spread your wings, it's a beautiful thing. Particularly now, in your soulless glass tower on Canary Wharf, to step outside the total unreality of that situation into a world where you have to acknowledge the rising and the setting of the sun, the movement of the moon, the existence of the planet beneath your feet, and to face the ancient sanctuary in Mecca, and to practice a ritual that nobody has ever changed since it was first initiated. That's a very powerful privilege, and that can keep you sane in that otherwise crazy world of investment banking. And every one of those big buildings in Canary Wharf actually has a Muslim prayer room now. There are other practices, the fast of Ramadan, again, not an easy option. No food, no drink, no smoking, no sex, from dawn to dusk, every day for a lunar month, 28 or 29 days. That's quite a major commitment to make. But by and large, the Muslims do. Helmut Kohl said that the reason why Turkey shouldn't join the European Union was that 80% of Turks observed the fast of Ramadan. He thought that made them completely unassimilable to any possible secular European reality. People are alarmed by the energy that can make people relinquish such obvious normal human pleasures, but it's still very widely observed. And then the tax, the alms tax, the zakat on your wealth, not on your income, a 40th every year of what you have has to go to the poor, basically, including, of course, great charities like All for Aid. And finally, the Hajj, which is in the spirit of all of the other practices, it's waking us up, going back physically to that Abrahamic place and to see the reminder of the original vision, the Maqam al-Mushahada, when we said, yes, you are our Lord. That's what circling around the Kaaba represents, reminding ourselves of what we were doing before all of this stuff existed. That's a very powerful reminder. And the Hajj seems to make no sense at all. And if you're a Muslim and you've done it for the first time, it's like nothing else you do in Islam, but it has a very powerful alchemical effect. When I was living in Saudi Arabia, I knew a German lawyer, and he had a Muslim wife, and he admitted very happily that he'd converted to Islam so he could marry her. But neither of them were worried about prohibitions on alcohol or anything else. But he said one year, I've got Muslim in my iqama, my permit to stay here, so I'll do the Hajj. It might be interesting to look at. He comes back a week later, and he's completely changed. He's praying five times a day. He's in this Arab get-up, and he's got this kind of faraway look in his eyes. Of course, his wife, who's got the whiskey in one hand, is horrified. I don't know if the relationship survived. But what it did to that man's soul, I don't know. But one does see it again and again, that people are softened and transformed by the Hajj. I recently did an interview with a British non-Muslim journalist for Radio 4 about the Hajj, and I asked her, how did you get into this subject, not a religion journalist? And she said she was changing planes recently at Athens Airport, and she saw this woman. She didn't know if she was a Muslim woman or not. She wasn't dressed in any special way, and she had an extraordinary expression, extraordinary look in her eyes. She didn't look like anybody else that one would see in a transit lounge. So she thought, I better find out, who is this extraordinary person? She got talking to her, and it turned out that she had just come back from the Hajj. And so the journalist thought, the Hajj is pretty interesting. And she did actually a very good documentary on the Hajj in terms of its alchemical power to transform souls. So that's where we are, and I've been told very firmly to shut up. But I hope, inshallah, I've at least confused you in a constructive way. Just to revert to my initial point, it is very difficult, and it's really nobody's fault, and it's not specifically to do with Islam, but it is very difficult to explain what religion is about to many people who, through no fault of their own, have been brought up in a culture in which most people haven't heard of religion, except as some perhaps extremely soppy thought-for-the-day thing that just agrees with whatever liberal idea might be in the air at the time. But real religion, real faith, real self-sacrifice, transformation, being prepared to be unpopular if necessary, is something that people have not been exposed to. So I apologize if I've been talking complete gobbledygook, but maybe at least I've provided the opportunity to ask some interesting questions. So thank you very much. Is anybody going to chair this? What's the formal structure? I believe questions will be now, is that right? Okay.